The first case on our calendar is 08-2106, Ushanta Beckett versus Richard Warren. Mr. Wiley.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please this honorable court. My name is Don Wiley. I represent Richard Warren and Mary Truett Woods in this case. They were the defendants in a dog bite case that was tried in Summit County, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there on the clock.
I will. The sole issue before this court is whether a plaintiff pursuing a claim for bodily injury damages in a case involving a dog are required to elect between pursuing a statutory claim under the 955.28 or a common law claim for negligence. I understand that the court's read the briefs and is familiar with the facts of the case, and I will address my comments to why I believe this should be answered in the affirmative, that an election should be made in a dog bite case. And that's because if we look at the differences between a common law cause of action and a statutory cause of action, and if we look at the history of the dog bite statute and how it's been treated by the courts for almost 100 years now, I think this question has to be answered in the affirmative. Now, first of all, with regard to a common law claim for negligence, we're all familiar with the requirement that if you're going to sue for a dog bite under the common law, you have to show that the owner of the dog knew or should have known that the dog had vicious propensities. As what is, we may all remember back to our first year in law school in torts class when a chuckle went up when we heard about the one free bite rule. And that was meant to explain that if the dog had bitten someone before, you're on notice that your dog has vicious propensities, and therefore you can sue somebody if the dog's bitten someone before. It also means if the dog has never shown vicious propensities prior to a bite, that the victim of a dog bite had no cause of action that they could pursue at common law. And in absence of a statute, there would be no cause of action against that dog owner. It's a tough fact situation to prove. And in this case, the plaintiff over the plaintiff's objection was required to make an election before the trial of the case, and they chose the statutory cause of action. And I'll give a brief example of what they would have had to prove and what the facts would have been had they chosen the common law cause of action. And I believe the facts in this case would have shown that about a month before this bite occurred, this dog, whose name was Roly Poly, he was a Rottweiler Sharpei mix, who had lived with his family for 2 years and had never had problems before, and had never had problems with this young lady who was injured by the dog before. This young lady was best friends of a young lady that was also living at this house, a niece of Mary Woods, and had been to our house every day for 7 months prior to this incident, every single day, and for many sleepovers, and had never had an issue with this dog. She loved this dog and got along great with this dog. But about a month before she was bitten, my clients were having a party for adults. Adult beverages were being served. And one lady, perhaps because she had drank too much, put a piece of pizza in her mouth, got down on her knees, and, in my view, teased the dog into taking the piece of pizza from her mouth. And the dog, in snatching the pizza, lacerated her lip, and she needed a couple of stitches. That would have been the prior bite that they would have used to show vicious propensities of the dog. I think I would have countered that that was not a vicious attack, that was teasing of the dog, that it would not qualify as putting the owners on notice that this dog was vicious. In addition, under the common law, you not only have to prove vicious propensities, the Court of Appeals opinion, in fact, cites cases and sets forth the four requirements of a common law dog bite action. And one of those requirements is that you show that the owner was also negligent in keeping the dog. And I think under these circumstances, when you have a child visiting the home who has this kind of history with the dog and this kind of relationship with the dog, I would have made the argument that it was not negligent for them to have the dog and this girl together under these circumstances.
In the statutory scheme that has been passed, you don't have to show any of that. You simply show the dog bit the child.
Yes.
You recover the compensatory damages, but no punitives.
That's exactly the difference.
So the question I have is, if you allow the two actions together, where is the prejudice if there's no dispute that the dog bit the victim, whoever
yes.
the victim was. Dog bites the victim, so under the statute you get compensatory. And if you put in all the information about prior history and you try to establish viciousness or negligence or all those sort of things, and you fail,
right.
where is the prejudice? Because it's a pretty clear-cut recovery under the simple fact that the dog bit the victim and you get compensatory. So where would the prejudice be if you allow the other information? The jury doesn't accept it, doesn't believe it, but still you have the statutory recovery for the compensatory.
Right, and it is extremely prejudicial. Trying a case under the statute is a very difficult thing to do from the defense point of view because there is no defense.
But where is the prejudice? I mean, you've got, as you said, almost no defense. If the dog
right.
bit the person, that's the end of the story.
Right.
So you bring in all this other stuff, and the jury doesn't accept it and doesn't give them
right.
any punitives. Where is the prejudice to your client?
Because the prejudice is it brings in evidence that inflames the jury or would tend to increase the amount of the damage awarded. Under the statutory...
believe that they would then up their compensatory,
absolutely.
Even though they didn't accept... But they would have the chance, if they were inflamed, to say, viciousness, negligence, whatever, we're going to give punitives.
Right.
And they're not choosing to do so, so where? How can you prove that they were inflamed and they upped the compensatory?
Well, I think it's extremely prejudicial because, you know, if you sit through a deposition of a dog owner... you know, you're allowed to plead in the alternative, so everybody does, and everybody does discovery on both causes of action. And if you're sitting through a deposition with a talented plaintiff's lawyer and they're talking to the homeowner about, you know, what research did you do into this breed or its temperament, or what kind of training did you do, or why didn't you send it to obedience school because it cost $120, or, you know, the homeowners are extremely uncomfortable, and if all of this evidence is coming in on a dog bite statute case, whereas the precedent before the court is that is inadmissible evidence under the statute. Under the statute, that is not it evidence that comes in. And then,
Well, it's just not required under the statute. The statute doesn't say you may not allow that evidence, does it?
The statute doesn't, but prior decisions from this court have. The Klebold case was a case from 1913 that said that the court in that case was reviewing a case that had been tried under the dog bite statute as it existed at the time, and the judge had let in at the trial court level evidence of the prior bad acts of the dog, and the Supreme Court said that was inadmissible and reversible error. And it is prejudicial because you have no defense to these statutory causes of action. I think that was the quid pro quo for why these statutes are enacted. It was saying, look, we're going to give compensation to first-time dog bite victims, but in exchange for that, we're not going to permit punitive damages.
Well, counsel, it seems that your theory, because we're not at the moment discussing whether or not you get the punitives. The jury didn't give punitives here, right?
Well, they weren't. This was tried under the statute, so no.
Okay. Your underlying assumption is that if, let's forget about dogs. Let's take car wrecks.
Okay.
That if the driving is really horrible and all of that, that's when you're presenting the negligence case, that the more egregious the driving is, the larger the compensation the jury is going to be for compensatory damages.
Yes.
That seems to be your theory.
Well, yes. I think if you let under the
do,
dog
do
bite,
we have cases that say that?
That cite that more egregious
that say, well, you have to in any kind of negligence action, you have to keep it down to the bare bones and keep out the horrible stuff.
Of course not.
Because it might influence how a jury assesses damages.
Of course not. But dog bite cases are different. Under a dog bite statute, the only issue is whether you were bitten And how much damages are you entitled to? And
well, it's a stop sign violation. The only issue is, did you go through the stop sign? The plaintiff isn't going to be able to show you were texting when you went through the stop sign?
I don't know. Maybe the analogy would be, because you're being held responsible in a dog bite case for the actions of an animal, maybe if we were talking about a negligent entrustment claim in an auto accident case, it would be a better analogy, where you're talking about, did you know or should you have known that your kid was a bad driver already or had done something in the past? So maybe that would be a
did you try this
analogy.
Case?
Yes, sir.
Because the plaintiff's description of the injuries is pretty horrific. And when we look at the amount that was awarded, it would seem that you did a pretty good job of getting the jury to focus on the damages. And I mean, the result seems to undercut your argument about prejudice to the damages.
Well, thank you for your comment. But this was initially a really gross thing to look at. The plaintiff's scalp was peeled back.
Pretty gross to read about.
Well, it was pretty gross to look at, and they had pictures. For some reason that I'll never understand, the emergency room department allowed the mother's boyfriend to come in and take pictures on his cell phone of them actually lifting her scalp up as they cleaned it off. And every photograph that they had was admitted into evidence. And this was one of those courtrooms with plasma TVs everywhere. And these pictures became the wallpaper of the courtroom. The jury saw all of them. Fortunately, whoever worked on this young lady at the emergency room did an incredibly fantastic job of sewing her back up. Her follow-up treatment essentially consisted of 5 visits with a plastic surgeon who looked at the top of her head and said, "That looks incredibly good. You're doing fine." That was it. Her medical bills were $500. And I mean, it was a gross injury initially, but it had a fantastically good ending. And the plastic surgeon, she had a very small scar that was barely visible. She was paraded in front of the jury so they could look at it. And she has a ridge scar in her hairline that the plastic surgeon said, "I can revise that for $2,500, but why? It's hidden by the hair. It's not causing her any problems. There's no muscle damage. There's no nerve damage."
But doesn't the jury's outcome on damages undercut your argument of
prejudice?
I
don't think so. They gave her $500 for her actual medical bills. They gave her $2,500 if she ever decides to have that operation in the future. And they gave her $2,500 for pain and suffering. And perhaps influenced, trials are influenced.
You didn't have any evidence of any prior, I mean, you strictly tried under the statute. They elected, correct?
Yes.
And so you did not have all this other evidence that you claim could have inflamed the jury.
That's correct.
Although it's hard.
And I wasn't allowed to introduce evidence.
More.
Excuse me. I wasn't allowed to introduce evidence that the dog had gotten along great with this girl for 7 months or any of that.
But nor could they introduce evidence of this prior teasing and.
Correct. That's correct.
We oftentimes, rely upon trial judges to instruct jurors as to what evidence they should consider and what evidence they should not consider and for what purposes. What's your concern here? The trial judge couldn't give an instruction if there's no election and all the evidence is permitted under common law and statutory theory. Why can't the trial judge give an instruction to the jury telling them that you don't, in determining damages, you don't consider whether there's, or you may consider, whatever. I mean, if you want to, you can, obviously the trial judge can tailor what the jury considers. Now, you can argue, well, but the jury, it's in their mind. But we have that problem when every time a trial judge gives a limiting instruction.
Well, first of all, if you look at every case that I've cited in my brief, and there aren't a lot of Supreme Court cases on dog bite cases, but if you look at every single one, and if you look at every reported case on dog bites, you'll find that an election is made. The only case where one wasn't made was in Youngstown, and it was such a mess. If you read the dissenting opinion in that case, they said, "We're not going to rule today whether you have to make an election, but this case is a good example of why you should, because it made a mess." And you have different burdens of proof. You have different standards of evidence. You have evidence that's admissible in one action but not admissible in another, and you have different remedies. under just plain election of remedies principles, as pointed out in our reply brief, this is a situation where historically and for good reason an election has to be made.
I guess I'm having a little problem with you're saying that evidence, so-called common law evidence, that the owner's knowledge of the fact the dog may be like to bite, that that's not permitted in a statutory.
Yes.
It's not needed, certainly, and that's obviously.
It's not relevant.
Not relevant, but, well, yeah, not needed at least. Do we have to say that we have? Do we have to make that conclusion in this to get to the decision in this case? Rule of law.
That conclusion's been made since 1913, reaffirmed in 1924, reaffirmed in the 60s by this court, that evidence of prior bad acts of the dog is not admissible because the statute's in derogation of the common law, and it was meant to help out the plaintiffs, but it's not meant to give the plaintiffs a free shot and say, look, we're going to go for the punitive damages, which terrorizes the homeowners in these cases. And if you can't make it, you're still going to win under this statute. They're different remedies. They're different outcomes. They're different. The evidence that's admissible in one is not admissible in the other. And I want to go back to the question about why the damages were
actually,
so
low. Actually, you've used your time.
You know what? It says I've still got a minute.
The red light's on.
Oh, I'm sorry. That must mean I'm over my time.
I defer to the marshal on those kinds of questions. Thank you. Mr. O'Shea.
It's over a minute.
Good morning, Chief Justice and members of the court. I'm Michael O'Shea, and I have the honor of representing the Beckett family in connection with this appeal to this court. This court and the courts of Ohio have overwhelmingly permitted the pursuit of common law and statutory causes of action, including but not limited to the filing and trial presentation and recovery under RC 955.28, what we call the dog mauling statute. I find out, and as I indicated in our brief, that I note with interest, and I understand it's for tactical purposes, that the defense in this case has consistently referred to, and I'll bet you it's replete through their brief, that this was a, quote, dog bite case. Nothing could be further from the truth. This was a dog mauling case. As the evidence, and there's no contradiction.
Does that make a difference?
It only makes a difference for purposes of persuasion, Your Honor. And
but it doesn't make a difference on what you recover, does it?
Well, I think it does in the sense that if someone just bit you and you had, at best, piercing marks on you, that's dramatically different.
That's just an issue of damages, what type of damages. But whether you maul or bite, how does that make what's the difference legally to us?
Well, as long as the court understands what the real facts are, that's all I need to point
out.
Trust
me, I think we do that.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, rather than focusing on the extent of the damages to the young lady, this comes down to an interpretation of the statute and the case law on whether an election is forced. Now, the trial court said you've got to pick your poison here, and they did, and they have minimal recovery as a result of it, or you do, your clients, and now they've got to go back for a new trial, correct, based
yes.
on the appellate court's decision. If we would affirm the appellate court's decision, they start over, you start over, and you're allowed to bring in all the details that you're trying to get before us right now, correct?
Correct.
And I guess this boils down to an interpretation of the either-or language that is, was it Rosenberger, Rosenberger?
I believe so, yes.
That says either-or and said both theories could exist simultaneously. And is that the controlling issue that we need to address here?
Yes, but can I say yes with a caveat, Your Honor? The real issue in this case is what facts get to be presented to the trier of fact. If you get to present to the trier of fact,
which is focused on what theory you're going to choose, what cause of action, statutory or common law, determines what facts are essential. There might be extraneous facts, as the Chief mentioned, that you could bring in if the trial court allows you to do so. And whether or not they're prejudicial to the defendant or the plaintiff is a matter for the trial court to deal with. So we're not really looking at prejudice. I think we're looking at the legal command here. Is it either or? And did the Court of Appeals get it right in determining that that doesn't preclude? In other words, the statute is not doesn't preclude a common law. And there's no language in the statute that says it does.
That's correct, Your Honor. And as I was going to point out, and let me segue right into my next comment, and that is that the General Assembly has gone to great lengths quite recently in telling us what punitive damages are about statutorily, how to present them, what cases merit them, what cases do not. They did nothing in that regard to 955.28. They could have, when they scoured the Ohio Revised Code, said, by the way, that statute has some ambiguity to it too, and we got to determine whether if you pursue a statutory dog mauling cause of action, you're precluded from asserting punitive damages. They did not. They did it in other sections of the revised code quite clearly, but they didn't do it here. So what
are
I
you,
think—
Are you claiming that you are entitled to punitive damages under the statute, or are
no.
you claiming your the common law theory?
I'm saying, Your Honor, just so that I'm clear, that I'm entitled to pursue both a common law action, which okay. has punitive damages simultaneously with that of the statute.
Now, if you did not have the statutory right and you only pursued a common law right, you could not prove prior bad acts, you could not prove negligence. It's simply a first bite case. Do you recover?
I don't think I understood the question.
Okay, you don't have the statutory right that's given you that says you bite him the first time, you get compensatory. You don't have that. Just have your common law action. You cannot prove prior bad acts or prior acts of the dog. You can't prove the owners were negligent. This is a first bite situation. No question the dog bit the child, but no history or anything like that. Do you recover compensatory at least under common law?
I believe you do, but I think in order under the common law for you to recover anything, you have to prove the bad acts because you have to prove the propensity. You have to show that the owner was
on notice. So you don't get recovery under common law for just the first bite with no priors?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So, I think there was an excellent point made just a moment ago about negligent per se cases. And in the context of an auto accident case, let's say that a drunk driver runs a red light or runs a stop sign and hits somebody. Under the doctrine, the underlying doctrine that the appellants are proposing here, that if you choose to pursue the negligence per se cause of action, you're prohibited from telling the jury the guy was drunk. You're prohibited from pursuing punitive damages because the legislature or the courts have given the remedy of this per se thing, which kind of lowers your standard of proof. So, and what we're saying to the court is that by the passage of 955.28, and as we indicated in our brief, the General Assembly was obviously trying to help people who get attacked by dogs, not prevent or present barriers to their recovery.
Counsel, the statute doesn't say anything about election of remedies, does it?
Nothing.
Is there a general rule on election of remedies that would apply to this case as it would apply to other cases?
Well, in the reply brief that the dog owners filed, Your Honor, they talk about the Pella window case, the Norwood McDonald case, and the Koroshak case. I believe it was just referred to as the Youngstown case. And they talk about that election of remedies doctrine, which is, quite frankly, kind of an older doctrine that is somewhat merged into, to a certain degree, res judicata, if you read the case law and you read those cases. So basically, they say that if you have a cause of action, you know, if you have an incident that has occurred, a wrong to you, you have this obligation to pursue everything when you are asserting your claim in a courtroom. Otherwise, you're barred from ever from doing it. Now, there are some limited exceptions to that. And as a matter of fact, the Pella window case and the Norwood McDonald case talk about res judicata and election of remedies sort of simultaneously and give them, they give res judicata a lot more attention, and they give somewhat of a small amount of marginal lip service to this doctrine of election of remedies. But they basically say if the facts, and as a matter of fact, they say that in order for this limited doctrine, which I don't think is even, quite frankly, given the recent development of res judicata issues and decisions rendered by this court, really even applies anymore. I don't know if this court's even heard of the doctrine prior to this case. I hadn't until I read the reply brief, quite frankly. But it appears that if you have two separate lawsuits involving a slightly different set of facts, a different wrong, then you have this election of remedies issue kicks in, and that's when this whole doctrine comes in, this older doctrine.
Mr. O'Shea, under the civil rules, under I believe it's not sure exactly of the 8 AD, the joinder of as many claims, whether they're consistent or not. I mean, we basically say in the rules that you can proceed to assert these claims, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
That was one question. The second question I had under 955-28B, the statute talks about damages, but doesn't say anything about, but not punitive damages, and it seems that everybody's saying you can't get punitives under the statute. What authority is there for that statement?
You mean for the...
What authority is there to say that you cannot get punitive damages from simply a statutory claim?
One case that the trial court in Summit County relied upon that the Court of Appeals for Summit County rejected. And that was the sole case that said that. That's the only case that's ever said that.
However, we have a case that talks about the word damages and interprets it to mean every type of damage, don't we? Isn't there a statement to that effect?
That's the way I read it. I see, again, I'm a statutory constructionist by nature, Your Honor, and I see 955-28, unless it says, and as we also said in the discussion in our brief about stare decisis, and as well as the doctrine about how common law actions survive statutory codification. As a matter of fact, I was on the losing end of a case, the Vaccarello case that we cited, where this court said just because we've codified something does not mean that we've eliminated anything in the common law unless we specifically say so. Now, our General Assembly has heard that because recently when they did some codification, particularly in the Product Liability Act, they did just that. They said, by the way, in case there's any confusion, we, by codifying here, are telling you that the common law actions are codified and this is it. Nobody did so in 955-28 when that was passed at all. So by operation of codification law, if you can give me that, this is what we have here. The General Assembly has not spoken on this issue. The dog owners in this case want this court to operate essentially as a General Assembly and take the punitive damages statute, modify that a little bit, modify 955-28, and do all that and make a barrier for people to recover compensatory and punitive damages.
Does our recent opinion in Traylor, the criminal case, does that in any way affect your position in this case?
It does not. There is a case that this court has issued, the Warner versus Wolf case. That case made it very clear that you can pursue both causes of action, and stare decisis, as we've discussed in our brief, basically requires the party seeking this court to change its position has to prove a number of things in order for this court to disregard the stare decisis mandates or barriers to changing essentially the law in Ohio. Our position is...
The appellant indicates to us that the existing law is an election remedies and that if we adopt your position, we're actually changing longstanding principles of law that apply to the dog cases. Do you disagree with that?
I do, Judge. I would just ask you to read the briefs, and we explain what law is.
I have read the brief.
I meant perhaps again in that regard. Maybe Mr. My esteemed colleague will read them too. But
you rely on Wolf, but as you know, the reply brief, we do read the briefs. The reply brief indicates that response to Wolf is that. Quote, a suit may be instituted either under the statute or at common law. That's the last phrase in the syllabus in Wolf. Either or, do you want to argue that not doesn't mean you have to make a choice, that you can both cause of action are open to you?
Or? Certainly, Your Honor. They, in making that argument in their reply brief, they talk about, as I just discussed a moment ago, the Pella case, the Norwood McDonald case, and the Krusiak case, and about this election of remedies, and that's their case law support for the idea that the way you read the Warner case is that you have to choose and you can only pursue one, or more specifically, apply or present only one and only one to the trier of fact. But if you read Pella Window and you read Norwood McDonald and the Krusiak case, they are cases of very, very different set factual scenarios. Pella Windows involved one lawsuit that was filed in the bankruptcy court and litigated, and another subsequent lawsuit by different parties in the common pleas court. So that doesn't apply here, and that's where they discussed the older doctrine of election of remedies. And even there, they said that doctrine only applies if the remedies are entirely inconsistent with one another. And that's not what we have in this type of case. The remedy that the plaintiffs were looking for in this case, both through either road, the common law or the statutory, were entirely consistent with one another. They were looking for the, if they were allowed to present punitive damages, they would get a little bit more money, but the same proof would be presented essentially, with the exception of the prior acts, essentially. And in the Norwood McDonald case from 1943, that essentially involved two separate lawsuits, not one, two.
Well, counsel, what about the Koroshek case, which is a case that is stands for the proposition that you make a selection?
I don't think it does stand for that selection. If you, the way I read the case, and I read it again last night and this morning when I came in here, is basically in that case, the trial court made a mistake in their jury instructions, but not a pronouncement in the jury instructions. The trial court said the plaintiff in that case pursued essentially a statutory cause of action. And the plaintiff said, "Dear judge, prior to instructing the jury, I'm just going to take all my apples and I'm going to put them in the statutory cause of action and that alone, and that's what my case was." That's what they elected to do. So they left out a lot of evidence that they could have otherwise put on in a negligence case. But the judge, nevertheless, if you read the opinion, said, "I'm going to instruct," I think it went on for 14 pages, about negligence anyway. And it was the plaintiff's position in the Koroshek case that confused the jury. That's different from what we asked. We were asking the court to give us both. In that case, the plaintiffs in that case asked for only one and one only. And the Court of Appeals said, look, they were pursuing a 955-28 cause of action. Giving them an instruction on negligence was just plain error. And you confuse the jury.
Well, actually, they do talk about confusing the jury based on the portion of the opposing counsel's brief. They talk about how difficult it is when you're commingling and it invites confusion of the trier of fact. And that is, the trial court will inevitably be called upon to decide the admissibility of evidence that might be proper under one theory but inadmissible under another. And that is if the two theories are pursued simultaneously. While that process might not be too cumbersome relative to a dog bite case tried to the court, it is going to be a daunting task for a jury of laypersons to sift through the evidence and properly assign it to one of the two causes of action before it, which, you know, we discussed earlier with the chief's question, isn't that, if that is true, that it is cumbersome or confusing, that the trial court can remedy that with instructions? And this case doesn't seem to stand for that, that's the role of the trial judge to control the evidence and how the evidence is viewed with jury instructions.
I agree, and I would tell you that language in the decision, as I read it, is somewhat anecdotal. It really wasn't a pivotal issue in the case. In addition to that, I'm a firm believer that jury instructions, when properly given, are followed by juries. I mean, juries have, Your Honor, they have plenty of cases where they'll have, for instance, a murder, kidnapping, rape, and they get presented with different information on different causes or counts in an indictment, and they're instructed. You have to use this evidence for this evidence for this, and juries, as we know from many decisions from this court, are presumed to follow the instructions. So I think it's quite capable for a judge in a case, if someone's allowed to pursue 955-28 and a common law, for the judge to say, by the way, here's how you can apply this evidence and lay out the instructions and do it. Juries are presumed to follow those instructions, and just this insinuation that somehow our jury pool will be so confused that they will be unable to follow those instructions, I think is disingenuous to our juries.
Counsel, your red light's on, but I want to follow up on Justice Lenzinger's question, and you seem to feel that you could arguably be entitled to go after punitives just with the statutory election. That you make the statutory election, but punitives could still be in the case. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Now, if you do that, in terms of presenting evidence that relates to the punitives, are the hurdles, the 4 points that are required to establish negligence in there, or is it just a free-for-all?
Well,
on what the jury can consider as to punitives?
I think that the punitive damage statute that I just made reference before kind of guides us in that regard, that there has to be some sort of in limine type of pretrial discussion about what is allowed to be permitted for purposes of the common law action and what's going to be allowed to be permitted and in connection with the punitive damages pursuit. So that's the statutory framework.
If you made the statutory election but were permitted to go to punitives, you wouldn't necessarily have to show that there was negligence in keeping the dog.
Let me tell you this. I would certainly try at the trial level for tactical purposes to give the jury as much information about the prior propensity and the knowledge, even though I'm pursuing the statutory action, and I would say that I'm doing that under the common law action. I'll bet you Mr. Wiley, if he's there, is going to try to prevent, assuming we remand this thing, he's going to try to prevent enough of that, saying, look, under the punitive damage statute, you're kind of limited to what you can present to the trier of fact.
But, counsel, you didn't make that argument at trial. You tried this case, right?
I did.
And you chose the statutory?
I did.
And you didn't argue at the trial court that we are entitled to punitives.
I was barred from doing that. The judge made it very clear that I could not.
Under the statute or under the election of remedies?
When I chose to go under 955-28, the judge made it very clear that prior acts and everything else that would otherwise be admissible in the common law type of action were barred, including essentially barring and completely any punitive damage possibility.
Did you appeal on the basis that the statute allowed you punitives? Or did you just appeal the election of remedies?
Just the election of remedies. And we had some other assignments of error, too, but they're not before the court.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea.
Thank you very much, sir.
Mr. Wiley, you've used your time that we've taken Mr. O'Shea well over his time, so take a minute if you want. You don't have to.
No. That's the opportunity. Thank you again.
Counsel, what's your thoughts on the availability of punitives under the statute?
That was going to be the first thing that I would address. The very first case that addressed the dog bite statute was Claybolt back in 1913, and as pointed out in our brief, one of the decisions from this court at that time was that because the statute was in derogation of the common law and did not provide for punitive damages are not available under the statute. And that has been followed consistently by every single court that's ever had a case with the statute being the elected remedy. There was one other thing I'd wanted to follow up on. There was some concern about maybe the damages in this case weren't big enough, and maybe that's a reason why, and you learn that bad facts make for bad law type situations. One anecdotal thing that happened in this trial, this plaintiff was a delightful young lady. She was very energetic and she was very positive about life. And when I was taking her deposition, I was trying to find out if she had any emotional issues because her physical injuries had healed so well. And I asked her if she was afraid of dogs in any way. And her comment to me was, no, I still love dogs and I want to get one. And so I figured when I cross-examined her, I would end with that note to make it a happy ending, if you will, for the story. And so I reminded her of her deposition where she told me she still loved dogs and she wanted one. And she said, yes, and we got one. And I said, really, what kind? And she said she was still afraid. She didn't like all dogs was her first comment. And I thought that was understandable. And I said, well, I understand that. What kind of dogs don't you like? And she said, I don't like Chihuahuas. And that caused some laughter. And I said, but she said she had gotten a dog, and I asked her what kind she had gotten, and she said it was a Rottweiler Pitbull mix. I mean, this girl had a good recovery. She really was a bright young kid. It really was a horrific thing to look at initially, but it really did heal up well. And the damage award, I don't think, was anything about, great lawyering or great manipulation of evidence. All of those pictures came in. The jury had a full idea of what happened here.
Well, counsel, I didn't mean to suggest to you it was too low. I meant to suggest to you that given the graphic nature of it,
yes,
could have been much higher.
It could have been, yes.
And so arguing that there's what the jury would award is somehow poisoned by the evidence of what happened,
right,
and the propensity of the dog, it seems to me, is undercut by the fact that the warden does not seem to have been influenced by passion.
I don't think it was.
Let me take it to the legal issue.
Sir.
The in your view, what weight do we give this element of whether the remedies are inconsistent or not? Here, it seems to me the remedies are really not, or the causes of action are not really inconsistent. Certainly the remedies are not. What's your view on that?
Well, I think they are very inconsistent. I think the fact, if you read the cases decided on the statute versus a common law cause of action, the fact that evidence that's admissible in the common law action is reversible error under the statute. Cases have been reversed for new trials because the court allowed evidence of prior bad acts in a statutory action. The procedures of the presentation of the case, certainly the reference to the civil rules, which allow pleading in the alternative, exist, but we also have evidence rules, and we also have rules about what's prejudicial. And the rule has always been, if you're going to give the person this free shot under the statute, any evidence that might tend to show that the dog owner was a bad dog owner is prejudicial, and it's reversible error to bring that in.
But the question of whether one receives compensatory damages only or compensatory plus punitives, are those inconsistent? Are they just different?
I think they're inconsistent.
One's an extension of the other.
I don't think the statute has ever been interpreted, as was represented to you, to permit punitive damages. I think since 1913, the rule has always been it does not.
No, but, yeah, okay.
And I think that the remedy of punitive damages under the common law is completely contradictory and inconsistent with the remedy provided by the statute.
But counsel, that's for the statutory comes in and should be utilized when that's all you have. In other words, that you've got a dog bite and you don't know the background of the dog, or the dog didn't have a background. But it seems to me that when you do have a situation that comports with the elements that you need to prove for the common law, that you should be able to utilize the common law, because it's a higher burden to show.
Yes.
And if you can meet that, so be it. Your only argument is that if you bring in the elements that you need for the common law, you're going to prejudice the jury, because usually the facts are going to be graphic and disturbing. And if they, that will skew their thoughts on how much the case is to be awarded, how much damages to be awarded in the case. But it seems to me that if at the very least you can show a dog bite, then you've got the statutory remedy. You've got
yes.
But if you can show more,
yes.
Because in fact there is more to the scenario, you exceed what is necessary for the statute, and then you recover under the common law theory. And I don't see the incompatibility of that view of a dog bite case.
Well, the courts have consistently found that for over 100 years, that the dog bite statute was in derogation of common law but did not abrogate the common law, so you can sue under either or and proceed that way. And the courts have always held that if you're going to pursue the statutory cause of action, any evidence of prior bad acts of the dog or any attempt on my part to show what a good dog this was is irrelevant. All we're going to concentrate on is what happened to you, what was your injury, and what's fair compensation for that. And that, in my view, was the quid pro quo of this statute, of saying we're going to give first-time dog bite victims compensation, but we're not going to put the homeowners at risk of thinking they're going to lose their house because their dog bit somebody. And that is a real terror that the dog owners suffer when the common law action is pursued. And the courts have always separated the two. The courts have always required an election, as I pointed out earlier. Every single case you read involved an election, except for that one Youngstown case. And now what the Ninth District Court of Appeals did in this case is unprecedented. It has never been ruled this way before.
You've used your minute, Mr. O'Shea. Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.